What does your car look like? Maybe you have a car seat in the back or just a collection of your things. When most of us think of customizing a car, this might include choosing fabric interiors or upgrading the standard radio to a better sound system. But for some, customizing a car is a hobby and expression of their personality. To chrome rims, elaborate murals, subwoofers, and hydraulics. On this Central Standard, we look at the culture of lowrider cars, what the customization includes, how art plays into the process, and the history of this subculture within the Mexican-American community. That's coming up after this hour's news. They aren't the type of cars that drive by unnoticed. Low-riding, shining, chrome rims, killer paint jobs, normally accompanied with a bumpin' sound system to go with it, subwoofers, and hydraulics. Cruising parts of town, bajito y suavecito, or low and slow. Low-rider cars cruise to impress, to be recognized, and admired in the public sphere. Often stigmatized as being related to gangsters, our guest today will share his research that debunks elements of this stigma. He'll tell the stories of the communities within the subculture, how lowriders are expressions of identity and serve as a social outlet within the Mexican-American community, the hip-hop scene, and modern custom car culture. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Ben Chappell, author of Lowrider Space, Aesthetics and Politics of Mexican-American Custom Cars. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
Ben is also an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas. His book, Lowrider Space, came out last year and is now available on paperback. We're going to start first with the history of lowrider cars and then kind of get into this gangster stigma. Can you talk about how lowrider cars first started and gained popularity?
Sure. Yeah. It's the history of lowriding is really closely connected to custom cars in general in the United States. And, of course, a lot of that comes from California. And so there's this whole history of, you know, cruising, American graffiti, Route 66, and that kind of thing. And what a lot of people don't realize is that Mexican-Americans were a part of that all along in places like San Bernardino. And basically the lowrider car style is the particular style of customizing cars that became popular in Mexican-American communities, and then that sort of reproduced itself as friends learned from friends and family members, and it became really closely identified with that specific history of Mexican-Americans.
Well, so what era are we talking about here? Like, how early are we seeing this pop up in popular culture?
Well, people were customizing cars in Mexican-American communities back in as far as the 40s and possibly earlier. And a lot of people will say that that's when the kind of low aesthetic really started in terms of lowering the suspension, or sometimes people would just put bags of concrete in the trunk or something like that. But that low slung look was something that was really popular. To talk about lowriders, though, as a distinct identity really was something that started in the 60s and 70s when it was kind of a new generation. And these were the Mexican-Americans born in this country who also became involved in the Chicano movement and civil rights struggles and things like that. So it was really a time of rising identity consciousness. And that's when lowrider became not just a car style, but a social identity as well.
So what kind of aesthetic changes happened during that time?
Well, one of the crucial ones that, anybody who gets involved in lowriders really starts to recognize is the hydraulic suspension. I mean, that's sort of one of the distinctive modifications you can do to a car and make it a lowrider. And that was something that Ron Aguirre, a particular a customizer in California, innovated. And that was actually something that was related to police regulation.
Huh.
Because in California, part of a reaction to customized cars there was a law that the body of the car couldn't be lower than a certain level in relation to the wheels. And what Mr. Aguirre did was he took the hydraulic suspension. I believe it was – it may have been from actually airplane landing gear, because you know, there's a lot of kind of industry in California at that time, surplus after the war and that kind of thing. But in any case, he took this hydraulic suspension so that he was able to raise the car when the police were looking and then lower it again to sort of go his way. So that was the innovation of hydraulics, but it became more and more elaborated so that people could really adjust – not only adjust the height of the car but make it bounce, go up on three wheels. And now the technology has developed so much that, you know, you have car dancing competitions and, you know, where the car's jumping completely off the ground. And that's been going on for, at least since the 70s and 80s.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But
sure.
Kind of getting back to that era, you know, there's these laws that are keeping people from riding low. And there's this association with kind of this gangster mentality, the zoot suit. What was going on there culturally, and what kind of oppression was this community facing?
Yeah, well, you know, the Mexican Americans of the post-war sort of era were really trying to find a place in this society where they were subject to residential segregation. There were other forms of racism. And there's also this idea of biculturality, where, you know, there's a background in Mexico, and yet you're in the United States, a lot of times a U.S. citizen. And so there's a sense of being betwixt and between. And so a lot of these cultural styles, like low riding, you mentioned the zoot suit, a lot of the cultural styles that came out of Mexican-American neighborhoods were about asserting a very specific identity. What low riders sort of express is a connection to these specific neighborhoods, communities, and histories. And so in that way, it's not just another customized car, but it's a customized car that's very closely related to the Mexican-American history.
And some of the ways that's expressed is in the way that they're decorated. And I'm wondering, can you give just a description of what a lowrider car is for maybe somebody that would have no idea?
Yeah, sure. Let's get back to basics. Well, I mentioned the hydraulic suspension. Not everybody can afford that right away, at least. You know, there are some other sort of classic styles like spoke rims on spoke rim wheels. Those are very popular and considered to be classic. Like you mentioned in the intro, very colorful paint jobs, a lot of times with multiple coats of enamel, so it's very shiny, or with a metal flake finish. A lot of times murals painted on the hood or the trunk or the roof or anywhere else. Another thing that is really, really common in lowriders is a customized interior. And so, you know, again, there are certain specific styles that became popular in certain communities. And with the lowriders, a lot of times it's a velvet interior, crushed velvet with tucks. And sometimes you'll have sort of luxury accessories like a chandelier or, you know, all kinds of things that add sort of flash and style to the car. So those are some of the common effects that make you say, oh yeah, okay, this is a lowrider. It's not a hot rod. It's not a street racer. It's a car that's designed to look great and to go on display.
But then, kind of going back into that, how that fits into this gangster culture. I mean, what are some of the common misconceptions and stereotypes that people see these cars and automatically associate it with? You know, that culture, probably because a lot of those classic cars were driven by gangsters during the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of factors there, I think. One is that the lowrider style, and you mentioned the zoot suits, or the sometimes it's called the pachuco style. These sort of forms of street culture were ways that people expressed this betwixt and between identity, but they also got read differently in the public. And, you know, for the authorities to see these young Mexican-Americans sort of asserting this identity, which was really a refusal of kind of assimilating to the mainstream of Anglo society, represented a kind of a threat. Now, when you talk about gangs and gang culture, you know, that's been a part of these same communities as well. I mean, In marginalized communities, a lot of times you can't really escape violence on an everyday basis. And so, gangs have been one way that people have organized to, out of self-defense or out of a need to belong. And there's a whole literature on that.
Right.
But the lowriders and pachucos were not necessarily all gang members, but they were close.
But so what are pachucos? That's a word that came up when I was doing research. And it's kind of, it can mean different things to different people.
Sure. Well, what's called the pachuco style was a kind of street cultural style that was, in those early days, in around the 40s. And it involved dress, it involved language. They actually developed a kind of a hybrid language. It's called Caló, and that's, related to – in fact, it's related to the a hybrid language brought to Mexico by gypsy bullfighters. This is the big picture. But a certain way of dressing, a certain way of carrying yourself, and a certain way of talking that sort of marked you as belonging to, this community. That's what people came to call pachucos. And then that's been kind of a contested style too, because in the 70s, the Chicano movement really embraced the pachuco style, or the memories of that, at least, as a kind of as a point of pride, really, as a kind of cultural and ethnic pride. And they remembered the pachuco era as a time when people stood up and said, you know what, I'm from these, I'm from East L.A. or I'm from the barrio, and yet I belong here, and you have to deal with me. So it's that sort of assertion of presence. When I say that these street cultures are close to gangs, I mean that in terms, geographically. In other words, you have gangs in the same neighborhood. It's an urban phenomenon, right? And there are gang members who are interested in street style, just like there are people who are into street style who are definitely not gang members. But the thing is that from the authorities' point of view, and from the point of view of the police, that visual style is something that you can just really latch onto and make sense of. And so there's been a lot of stereotyping all throughout this history. In fact, when I was doing my work, I did some research into how the police defined a gang. And actually, visual style was a big part of that. So in other words, it's not enough to make you a gang member if you commit crimes or if you're a part of a group that commits crimes, but you have to be a part of a group that identifies itself visually.
Another misconception is that lowriders is a youth phenomenon, when really, in your research, it kind of shows that it's something that maybe starts when people are young but goes on and is something that, people continue to do even towards the end of their life.
Absolutely. And that is something that I've tried to argue against, because, my research is a popular culture study. And in studies of popular culture, it's very easy to just talk about youth. Because, obviously a lot of young people are very active in popular culture. It means a lot to them. And that's true of lowriders as much as anything else. But I also think that in a way that can become a way to dismiss the culture and say, well, it's just kind of a phase, or, this is something that that kids go through before they really, become responsible in life or whatever. And I think that outside point of view is really wrong. In fact, a lot of the lowriders I met seemed like they really wanted to get that point across to me. People would tell me, first thing, it's not a fad. This is a lifestyle. And that was their way, I think, of expressing their commitment to it, but also saying that this is something that's bigger than just a youthful phase. And it's not just something that's going to come and go like fashion or like styles of music, but it was something that they were very committed to continuing.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about lowrider car culture, how these cars and the cruising scene represent a strong community and identity. Our guest is Ben Chappell, author of Lowrider Space, Aesthetics and Politics of Mexican-American Custom Cars. He's also assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas. Do you cruise in a custom car? Why do you cruise? Or what types of lowriders have you seen in your neighborhood or across the country? We want to hear about it. Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. So getting more specifically into your book, Lowrider Space, you were in Austin specifically. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to be in the lowrider scene in Austin and what you found?
Yeah, sure. Well, that's really a story of how I got into this line of work. I mean, before I moved to Austin for graduate school. That's why I went there. And before that, really into my early 20s, I mainly studied music. I was a musician, and so you could say that my main education was kind of in Western classical aesthetics. But I was also interested in the social world. I was interested in identity and social injustice and questions of racism and things like that. And so that's really what I went to grad school to learn about. And it's funny that aesthetics and politics ended up in the subtitle of my book because that's what drew me to Texas. The folklore program at the University of Texas in their literature said that they'll teach you how to understand the relationship between aesthetics and politics. So I thought, okay, I'm into that. And I was a child of the 80s, and I was interested in hip hop and graffiti and breakdancing, all these things. And how these sort of street cultures came out of urban communities and seemed to really engage with social issues. But I wasn't quite sure how. So I thought I would study something like that. But when I showed up in Texas, I saw a lowrider. I guess I knew what lowriders were from movies and things like that, but I didn't know a lot about them. But I'll never forget when I saw the first car. It was actually not a classic lowrider. It was a van. But it was covered in wild style graffiti, and it had 13-inch wire spoke wheels. So it was just a very dramatic presence, and it was cruising right by the university campus. And I just got such a sense that this car is really asserting itself. There's something going on there. And later on, I eventually met the owner of the van, and I was able to interview him and find out about his experience and everything like that. But it was just that moment of really being affected by this vision. I thought, I want to know more about that. And so from then on, lowriders were my project.
But are you a car guy, really?
I wouldn't have classified myself as a car guy before I got into this. I don't really work on cars. I'm interested in it. I really respect mechanics and I respect that the craft of it. But it wasn't what got me into the project in the first place. I kind of approached it from more of a cultural angle. The funny thing about it, though, was that the way that I do the research, I was doing an ethnography, and part of that approach means that I need to really find out what's important about it to the participants. And I learned that the mechanics and the carness of these cars is incredibly important.
You really immersed yourself into the scene there. And in the book, there's a lot of scenes where you're cruising with these guys. But I wasn't sure at times if you were cruising in your own car or if you were getting a ride with these guys.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it was a combination of things. I mean, when I first started trying to get involved in the scene, I would go out to the places where I knew that there were sort of cruising areas in Austin. One thing I learned was I was going out too early because I'd go out on a Friday at like 9 or 10 o'clock and it would really pick up like 11 or 12. But I at the time I was driving a 91 Toyota Camry. Which, it's kind of boxy. It's got some straight lines.
What kind of rims?
It was some aluminum rims that were a little worse for wear. But it was funny because I thought of this as a very sort of staid, nondescript car. But once I started to meet lowriders and show up at the cruising spots, they'd check it out and start thinking about, well, what could he do with this? And so they'd ask me, are those four lug wheels or five lug wheels? And in fact, one of the first lowriders I met was driving a Corolla of about the same year, which is, basically a similar body shape, but he had, a blue metal flake paint job and he had rims on it. So, I could have gone there with the Toyota, but I didn't actually. My plan was to work on a car, sort of from the ground up. And I made some progress in that direction. But what I found out was that the time I was committing as a graduate student researcher really wasn't sufficient. I would have to give a life to it probably.
We're going to take a call from Kristen in Loose Park. Kristen, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I grew up in California, Northern California, in the 70s, and the low-riding culture was very strong there. And, as a young girl, I didn't get it. But, we went to school with everybody, and there was a certain dress that the kids wore, and it was Dickies, like these work pants, and shirts, buttoned-up shirts to the top of the collar. The girls had super trimmed, like skinny, tiny eyebrows and heavy makeup. And then the cars, you know, so if you went cruising, you know, cruise the El Camino, that was like a big thing to do, they would be out in full force, and they would go, you'd get to a light, and then the cars would start going up and down and up and down. And I don't know if you mentioned it already, but neon was quite prevalent, and I love the neon, and the spinners, you know, the wheels and rims and all that. So it was definitely part of my childhood, and something that, as an adult now, I often think, I wish I could pimp my ride, and, you know, I'd love to have a little neon on my car and some spinners. I don't need the fuzzy dice or anything, but, you know, I think, I don't know, it's kind of a personalization of your car, and I think it's also a way to belong. You know, when other people were preppy, you know, they were their own style, and I certainly didn't see it as anything gangster, you know, when I was a kid anyway.
Kristen, thank you so much for the call.
Sure.
Yeah, could you elaborate more on this identity? You talk about identity maps in the book. What are those, and how do they relate to this culture?
Well, I think that one way to understand that is basically, like the caller was saying, performing these styles and putting them on display in public really creates a specific sense of time and place. You know, she's talking about remembering high school and remembering what it was like to go out on the weekends. And that's very much a part of the lowrider scene. You know, when I was cruising around, it was on a street called East Riverside in Austin. But then people would talk about, remember back in the day when we used to go to South Congress, or remember when we used to go to Chicano Park. And so, you know, a lot of it has to do with creating and sharing memories about specific places and specific experiences. So that's one of the ways that I got interested in the question of space. And like you said, talk about the ways that identity map or identities map the city. So one of the things that's interesting about lowriders to me is the way that they're tied to these specific histories and specific communities, but they move. Right. And so you can go out from the body or out from the neighborhood that, you know, that really produced these styles and travel around a city and sort of go on display. Now, that takes on a certain significance in cities that are historically segregated. And that's the case of Austin. You know, I love Austin. I enjoyed living there. And it's a great place in a lot of ways. But like Kansas City, it's got a history of segregation, and that history is not over. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely a sense that certain identities belong in certain places. And that's one of the ways that the city is really governed, not in legal terms, but in cultural terms.
In what ways do you see that in the ways that people express themselves through their lowriders?
Well, one thing is that every lowrider I've ever met had a very clear and developed sense of where they would be welcome and where they wouldn't. In other words, you know, you cross this street and you know that you're going to get attention from the police. A lot of people had stories of being pulled over, and not just pulled over because they were speeding or because their radio was too loud. That, you know, that might come up as a reason, but then the questions are, you know, what are you doing in this neighborhood? Are you lost? And so, you know, there was a sense that crossing over these boundaries with a very kind of distinctively marked car kind of challenged the order of things.
Talk a little bit more about how this is an identity beyond a car. I mean, our caller was talking about fashion and things like that. And earlier you said it's not a fad, but it kind of you can see how maybe it's sometimes it could come off that way as the way, you know, things are changing and becoming popular over time and then evolving and re-evolving.
Right. Well, I think that the reason that people like to emphasize to me that it was not a fad was, again, to sort of state their commitment. And so, it you know, it has some aspects of – there are fashion aspects of it, especially if by that you mean clothes. And the caller was talking about what's sometimes called a cholo style. And that's the more recent version of this kind of street culture, and it's very popular in the lowrider scene still, as far as I know. But it also kind of refers back to those neighborhoods, you know, and that sort of home base of the Mexican American community.
Was it hard for you to gain access or be welcomed as a person saying, hey, I'm just here to study you guys and I might try to do some things to my ride, but not really being as maybe deeply connected with some of these guys as you first started? Were they pretty accepting towards you, or what was your experience like?
Well, there are a couple of things that are interesting about that. One is that I definitely present lowrider style as a Mexican American kind of cultural expression, and that's, I think that's important for recognizing where it comes from, and also recognizing sort of who what's the cultural authority in terms of you know, who really decides what lowriding is. That said, in the lowrider scene that I was participating in, there was a kind of ethos that if you wanted to participate and if you were willing to do it, you were welcome. I mean, if you fixed up your car, it didn't matter what your background was. If you showed respect to the culture, then you could participate. And so there are, you know, all kinds of people involved. I should say all kinds of people, but predominantly blue-collar working-class folks. And that has to do with, you know, being involved in cars as well. There's a whole history of that connection. The other thing that I learned, though, trying to get involved in the scene was how it can be very intimidating from the outside. So, you know, when I would first start cruising around, I would see these groups of lowriders and, you know, try to think, well, how am I going to go up and explain to them that I want to, you know, do research, I want to write a paper about them? You know, it's kind of an intimidating presence. But as soon as I did make contact, which kind of ironically was through the internet, I found a registry of car clubs and ended up emailing one of them. And they were incredibly hospitable and welcoming. And they said, yes, you know, we have a meeting every Saturday night at the car wash. Why don't you come and we'll introduce you? So I met the vice president of the car club. He introduced me to the president. And then the president introduced me to everybody else. And, you know, I'm an Anglo guy, and I was a graduate student. You know, I wasn't really participating fully in all of the street culture around me in terms of dress and everything like that. I pretty much stood out. And the president, this is a great experience. He said, this is Ben. He's from the University of Texas. He wants to do some research about lowriders. So if you see him out there on the strip, he's not the police. And this is actually something that happened a couple of times, because over the years I would go back and I would know some of the people in the club, but there had been some turnover. And so the president would introduce me again and say, you know, he's not surveilling us. He's not the police. He just wants to learn about the culture.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're going to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Ben Chappell about lowrider space and culture. Plus, we'll talk about how this is all related to what Ben's researching now, the Mexican-American Fast Pitch Softball Tournament in Newton, Kansas. Believe me, it will all make sense in just a minute. Central Standard will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We've been talking about lowrider space, what our guest Ben Chappell describes as an assemblage of bodies, cars, and landscapes, and their sounds, colors, textures, and movements, a formation that emerges on some scale whenever lowrider style is on display. And that music you just heard is from Trampilla and the song Cruise On. How is the vehicle you drive or your mode of transportation a reflection of your identity? Or do you have any questions or curiosity about lowriders and the lowrider scene? Our guest Ben Chappell is here to take your questions. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. And Ben, we're going to continue our conversation about this lowrider style, its significance and form of cultural identity and pride. But just for a second, I want you to talk about the research you're doing right now and what this all has to do with fast pitch softball in Newton, Kansas.
Yeah, it might seem like a stretch, but I moved to Kansas and to KU in 2007. And so that was about a year after my last fieldwork with the lowriders in Austin. And it took me a while to write the book and wrap up that project. But when it was time to think about what my next research was going to be, I guess I could have continued with the lowrider topic, but I got really interested in fast pitch softball. mainly because it was similar to low riding in the sense that it was a cultural tradition in Mexican American communities. But I found out that it had a long history in this area, Kansas City area, and in Kansas, as well as in Texas, where I had done my original work. It was, you know, maybe a different generation of people than the lowriders I was mainly interacting with. If I had to put them both under the same umbrella, it would be about looking at the ways that Mexican-American communities create cultural traditions. And it's also got this nice element of surprise because you usually think about culture in terms of national origins. And so like you might think that the Mexican-American cultural origin is always always the nation of Mexico or that history. But really people create culture in everyday life, and they create it out of their own circumstances. So the fast pitch softball was something that I think really took off in Mexican American communities around World War II. Newton, Kansas, is the place where they claim to have the longest running Mexican American tournament. This year, they're going to celebrate their 65th year on 4th of July weekend, which is a pretty big anniversary. But it's not just Newton. I've actually done some work in this area. There are some tournaments here that have also been going for about a half century. The Kansas City Angels, the State Line Locals, who they play their tournament in Armordale. There are teams in Topeka and other parts of Kansas, as well as in Austin, San Antonio, and Houston. So for that project, instead of doing something that's really specifically located in one place, I'm trying to look at the network of these softball tournaments.
And then another kind of example of that, what I was finding is hip hop. I mean, hip hop seems to kind of bring all these different subcultures together. And we just heard a song from Trampilla. And, you know, everybody in the scene kind of listens to the same music, too. Can you talk a bit about how hip hop and hip hop culture fits in with this lowrider scene?
Sure. Well, and you know, hip hop is definitely a part of the lowrider scene, but that's also something that's historical. So, you know, at a certain point in the 70s, everybody would have said, well, if you're a lowrider, you listen to oldies. And what they mean by that is, you know, R&B and sort of early rock and roll and that kind of thing, which is still has a certain cachet in the lowrider scene. When I was doing my work, it was all hip hop. And, you know, I think there are reasons for that. It's also, like we talked about before, it's based in a kind of urban experience of, you know, coming out of marginalized neighborhoods. And it's also, there's a kind of ethos of trying to do as much as you can with the resources before you. I was actually just talking about this with a colleague over the weekend. He was comparing, lowriders to hip hop and referred me to this. There's this documentary about hip hop DJs called Scratch, and where one of the DJs says that basically the hip hop ethos is you've got a record on the turntable and it's a challenge. It says, what are you going to do with this? And that's exactly how it works with low riding. You have a car, and cars are so much a part of American life. But the question is, what are you going to do with this? How are you going to add something creative? How are you going to add your own special touch to this ubiquitous part of American life?
We're going to take a call from Sam. He called 816-235-2888. Sam, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What's your question?
Now, I don't actually have a question per se about lowriders and things like that. I just have a very personified vehicle. It's a two-tone 1996 Toyota Corolla wagon, and it has taken me over 5 music festivals, and my car is covered with bumper stickers from these music festivals. Of course, my hood is tied down, my muffler is held together by a beer can, zip ties. It's just a perfect reflection of my personality because I'm a little roughed up around the edges, but I still get by. That's about it.
Thanks, Sam. Well, yeah, and that's kind of what we're talking about here, how cars can be this expression of pride and identity. And you see that even what we were talking about a little bit before, when we were getting ready for this show, how truckers can decorate the inside of their rigs. And so, Ben, talk about this. What kind of, have you seen in your research as the different ways that people really express their personality in their vehicle?
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are all kinds of different styles and all kinds of, I call them genres of cars, as if they're, you know, different forms of art. And, you know, it's interesting because when you're doing a study on something like this, it's the temptation might be to sort of put it all in a silo and say, I'm only going to pay attention to lowriders, and lowriders are defined by these sort of classic styles. But I was more interested in lowriders in everyday life and what it was like to actually sort of be a workaday lowrider. And in my field site in Austin, it was all kinds of people and different kinds of cars who would come together in a cruising spot. That it wasn't always harmonious, you know. So sometimes there's a little tension between the lowriders and street racers, right? So there are people who tune up import cars to go as fast as they can, and that's a whole other sort of style. But you know, if one group is treating the street as sort of a promenade, and you're going to try to cruise and show off your chrome and your paint, and another group is using it as a drag strip, there might be conflict there, right? And so sometimes it was a matter of allegiances. You know, some of the older generation lowriders would sometimes complain about, well, these the young kids, they just want to go fast, you know, or they don't respect the more traditional ways or something like that. So that can happen. But I also think that the reason that cars are so much a part of this has to do with the way that traffic is a public space in our society. And that was one of the things, again, that led me to this this interest in space. If you look at the second half of the 20th century in American culture, you know, there's been a proliferation of private spaces, whether it's the rise of the suburbs where everybody has their own little piece of land as opposed to living in more condensed neighborhoods. Or shopping malls, you know, where instead of walking down Main Street, you're going into a building that's actually somebody's private property. You know, that's a big change. And traffic is one of the places that's still very public in the sense that people from all walks of life have to use the streets at some point and have to encounter each other at some point. And so that sort of raises the stakes in terms of identifying yourself in traffic. And in a lot of ways, I came to see the car as sort of an expanded body. Like people, you know, you have to identify your car if you want people to recognize you. And that's not only recognizing you as a particular identity, as from a certain neighborhood, but individuals will recognize each other. You know, if you see someone's car that you know driving down the street, you know it's your friend, or you know it's your rival, or whatever.
So cruising is a big part of this, a big part of the social side of this. And you talked a little bit earlier about some of the guys that you were hanging out with down in Austin being pulled over because they were recognized for cruising in certain areas. Can you talk about some of the laws that are in place that kind of keep certain areas from being cruised?
Sure. Yeah, well, there are different kinds of laws in different places. You know, some places will decide that cruising is a problem, and then they'll say, well, you can't drive past this point more than twice in an hour or something like that, or more than twice in a half hour. So there are specifically anti-cruising ordinances sometimes. That wasn't the case where I was at the time. They didn't have specific laws against cruising, but what they did have was a certain style of policing that came out of, in the 80s and 90s, it came out of certain gang scares, I guess. And it was really what I sometimes call a sort of lifestyle policing, where the idea was to pick certain areas of the city where the police expected crime to happen and sort of surveil them and look for anything that sort of drew attention. Well, if you're in a car that's designed to draw attention, you know, then you're going to encounter that or experience that in a certain way. So, you know, it was more about traffic stops and also just sort of the constant police presence than it was about a specific law.
Ben Trappel is the author of Lowrider Space, Aesthetics and Politics of Mexican-American Custom Cars, and an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas. We're going to hear from David now in Overland Park. David, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I've got a lot to say, so I'll try to make this quick. My stepson used to build custom lowriders, and I mean from the ground up. He started in mechanics class in high school. Him and his friend had an old car. They decided they were going to pimp it out, and he turned out to be so good at it that he made a living out of it. And one of the things you guys were talking about earlier about was the similarity with fashion. But one of the things that I learned after, you know, watching him for 10 years was that a lot of these guys never expect to be true property holders. So the money that you might invest or save and invest in a house, they'll put into their car. And I've seen my stepson build things that ended up being worth several hundred thousand dollars. I mean, and part of what he was saying earlier about the visibility factor, that's kind of part of the deal. It's like saying, you know, how can I possibly be causing any trouble if I'm so damn obvious about it? Mm-hmm. You know where I am. You can see me. You can hear me. You know I'm here.
Well, Ben, I was going to say, Ben talks about that. It takes a level of stability to own a lowrider. He mentions that in the book. Ben, can you talk a little bit about that? Because this stuff's not cheap.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely a source of respect. You know, people claim respect for being able to complete a lowrider. And, you know, the idea that that sort of true lowriders should be able to build the car themselves from the frame up, that's something that definitely, you know, I learned about. And you wouldn't have been you wouldn't have had the same status if you just went out and bought one. It's not the, you know, it's not the same thing. It's really a process, and it's a process of continuing to customize and modify and put your stamp on it. But I also think that the caller is really onto something by talking about not really having access to property or to capital, because you know, this, like I said, it's a Mexican American thing, but it's very much a blue collar thing too. In Austin, when I was doing my research, it was going through a high tech boom, and you know, a lot of economic activity, a lot of employment was around the information economy. It was around, you know, it was around high tech and also, you know, arts industry and things like that. And but all these people who were moving to town as information workers, you know, they drove cars, and somebody was fixing those cars. And so, you know, the mechanical work was really vital to society, but really not compensated well, or really not not well respected in the mainstream. And so sometimes I think that what a custom car represents is taking that those skills, those mechanical skills, which are sometimes, you know, that's called unskilled labor sometimes, because you don't need a high school diploma to do it, but it's certainly not unskilled. It takes a lot of skills to work on cars, and certainly takes a lot of skills to customize them. And so it was really trying to elevate that to a craft and aestheticize it as an art form in order to gain respect.
In what ways did you see people making ends meet to get their lowriders rolling?
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting parts of it to me, because there are all kinds of ways, but it's not out of pocket. You know, you don't just pay cash and go your merry way. So one thing that was really common was a lot of lowriders I knew actually worked as mechanics. They worked in car shops, and sometimes they could negotiate with their boss to work after hours. That was called side work. So like, if you knew somebody who worked in a shop and you needed some, you know, you needed something done to your suspension, you could come in after close and use the resources. There was a lot of bartering and trading. You know, if somebody was good at hydraulics, they could hook you up with hydraulics, and then you might, you know, note somebody else who's good at upholstery or good at paint. A lot of trading, a lot of reselling parts and cars. One of the lowriders I knew who had he had one of the best hydraulic systems. He actually negotiated with the shop that installed it, so that the hydraulics expert installed the system, and then the lowrider went back and worked for free to kind of work off the debt over the course of, I think it was something like 6 weeks. So, you know, it's not always about having a big pile of cash, but again, what can you do with what you've got? And if what you've got is relationships and people that you know and people that you're related to, you just sort of try to piece it together.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about lowrider car culture with Ben Chappell, author of Lowrider Space. I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of women in this scene. I'm wondering, if you looked at Lowrider magazine, you would probably have an idea of what it's a very subjectified magazine. Mm-hmm. But you've mentioned in the book that there's a lot of women that are involved in the scene that in very important ways. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in the book, I tried to draw a sharp distinction between what I call the lowrider media and everyday lowrider life. And Lowrider magazine would be probably the most famous example of lowrider media. And it's not that lowriders aren't into Lowrider magazine. It's a very important publication. But the magazine made a very specific decision that they were going to market to young men. They go something like 18 to 25. Right, and this is part of the reason for, like you said, the objectifying images of you know, of scantily dressed women on the cover and that kind of thing. And that way, it's not really any different than a lot of car magazines, and the whole field of custom cars is a very gendered field. Historically, men have been encouraged and rewarded for being into cars, and women have not. But that was actually very different from the everyday reality of low riding as I experienced it. Most of the lowriders I knew, in terms of, and by when I say most of the lowriders, I mean people who own and customize cars, were men. I met a few women who had cars and showed them or cruised them, but there are a whole lot of women in the scene around lowriding. So what I call lowrider space is this thing that happens when a bunch of lowriders are cruising around and they all go to the same parking lot, let's say, or they all go to the same park. And it really creates this scene that brings the community together. So there are, you know, there are older men and women, younger, you know, kids, there are families. Everybody's out there to sort of take in the social scene, to talk to each other, watch the rides cruise by, you know, talk about what they're going to do when they get their own ride and that kind of thing. You know, there are some other projects being done to document women's participation in lowriding. There's a documentary film that's in the works, and Denise Sandoval, who's another scholar who did her dissertation the same time I did, only in California. She's a professor at Cal State Northridge. She's done a lot of work to document how, even though Lowrider magazine was pitching itself to young men, there are a lot of women reading it and writing in letters to the editor and things like that. I think that women's participation in the lowrider scene is under-recognized. There's a lot more there than meets the eye if you approach it through the media.
We're going to hear from Sammy. Sammy, welcome to Central Standard on KCUR.
Hey, good morning to everyone. I grew up out in the West Coast, and although you're focusing mostly on the Latin American aspects of low riding, I've noticed that it's like a pan-cultural thing, with each group having its own unique variant to the low rider style. And I'm wondering if you've witnessed specifically the Afro-American style, the Asian style, or the white style of go ahead and fixing up their cars.
Ben?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like I said before, there are different genres, different styles of custom cars, and they do tend to get identified with certain communities. And that might be defined by identity, kind of depending on where you are. So, but it also, you know, those boundaries don't always hold. So, like in Los Angeles, there's actually a long tradition of African American low riding, and the cars are actually aesthetically similar to the Mexican American lowriders, and there's a lot of exchange and interaction there. But then you also have other car styles which are more specifically associated with a particular group. Now, when I was doing my work in Austin, it wasn't a big enough place to sort of support a whole lot of different cruising scenes. It was sort of like people would get together, and there might be, you know, one car in the style they call donks, and then, you know, another car that's more of a classic lowrider, and then some of the street racers that I mentioned before. And these might be associated with different social identities, but the boundaries were also porous. People would cross those boundaries sometimes.
What do you know about different low riding scenes in other countries?
That's an interesting area that I haven't done a whole lot of research on, but people keep asking me about it because it's really compelling. In the 90s, low riding really took off in Japan. And I think that's part of a general interest among young Japanese people in American culture. I had a graduate student who was interested in hip hop in Japan, and he was telling me that there are places in Japan where you can go and there's sort of like a little corner of LA reproduced, basically, where people are cruising lowriders and they're listening to hip hop and they're doing all these things that we think of as American culture. But, you know, these things also travel and they take on their own meanings in these places. Like I said, in the 90s, there was almost a little bit of concern that, you know, the classic lowriders are the early 60s Impalas. That's a really highly valued car, and A lot of people in Japan were buying these 64 Impalas and exporting them out of the United States. And it was almost like we're losing our national resource here, you know. But I think that probably most lowriders, they're so committed to the style that if they see other people taking an interest in it and starting to participate in it, that, you know, they feel like that's a good thing.
I want to talk a little bit more specifically about some of the classic cars that are typically, I guess, pimped out for to become a lowrider. You mentioned the Impala. What are some of the other ones? And then how is that changing, you know, as cars have changed over the years?
Yeah, well, one of the problems with trying to be a researcher of popular culture is that it changes so fast. And so, you know, as soon as you write something down, it's out of date. But there are still some classic styles. So I found that that GM was pretty much the preferred make. There are some Lincolns out there, but for the most part, people like GM cars. Chevys are starting the classic. The Impalas, you know, there are a number of reasons. You could look at it functionally. The early 60s Impalas had a very solid frame, and it was well-suited to hydraulics. I mean, it actually can hold up to all that bouncing. It also has a lot of flat surfaces, so it's a good canvas for your artwork. But it also was a family car that a lot of people remember, you know, being sort of the sign of success when your family was able to buy an Impala, and so there's some nostalgia to that as well.
Just real quick before we run out of time, did you find that most people who had lowriders also had their more practical car for getting around town, or would they ride the lowrider, you know, running errands and doing other things that, you know, you use your car for?
Yeah, it really would depend. I mean, I think everybody's ideal would be to have a car that they put all their customizing into and then have another car that they could drive in. And so if you're in a wreck, you don't lose your whole investment. But sometimes that wasn't an option and people drove their lowriders to school or work.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank Ben Chappell, professor of American Studies at KU and author of Lowrider Space, Aesthetics and Politics of Mexican-American Custom Cars. It's available through University of Texas Press and out on paperback. It's really interesting. Thanks, Ben, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard, where we'll be discussing the play Kansas City Swing. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and myself. Our intern is Claire McInerney. Up to Date is next with a look at the book Founding Finance and Child Safety. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy the day.